Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we're going to be talking about autogenics, autogenic training, the origins of this approach at self-hypnosis. And I have to admit that I had actually never even heard of autogenics until I heard a very interesting track, and I think in some DJ mixes from about a decade ago. But the track is called Group Autogenics 1 by the American-Dutch musical duo The Books.
I'd never heard of autogenics either. When you first proposed this subject, I was like, what is this? Is this where you create your own genome? That doesn't sound right. So I was totally unfamiliar with this kind of obscure, I guess, relaxation technique developed in the 20th century. And I will say I had never heard this song that you were linking to, but I looked it up and it's a great song, Robert.
Yeah, it's hard to describe. It's kind of a cut up of clips from various self-help and self-hypnosis tapes set to some very pleasing music. It's a wonderful track, and it's one that I find myself coming back to again and again just because it has a very, you know, pleasing atmosphere to it. And some of the little clips in it actually do kind of help me engage in a certain amount of self-relaxation. But it's really hard to compare The Books to other musical acts, or at least for me anyway. I feel like there's not a lot else out there that reminds me of The Books.
Hmm.
So this raised a big question, though, for me when I started listening to the song over and over again. I was like, okay, it's clearly referring to something. What is autogenics? And I'm not sure how much of the sampled material is actually from autogenics rather than other self-help and self-hypnosis tapes. But the book's member, Nick Zamuda, implied that it was essential to the intention of the track in a 2010 WordPress post that he made about the release. He wrote, quote, Wikipedia does a pretty good job of defining autogenics. Autogenic training restores the balance between the activity of the sympathetic fight or flight and the parasympathetic rest and digest branches of the autonomic nervous system. This is a pretty good description of what music does as well, so it seemed like a good pairing. And then he continues. Unfortunately, a lot of the music that accompanies guided meditation productions is schlocky New Age. Don't get me wrong, I'm not opposed to schlock. It certainly has its place, but my goal became to reframe this bizarre narrative with music that could propel the track gently and still go on unexpected tangents where necessary.
You know, I'm not sure if these recordings of these guided meditations or exercises are autogenics because at least in some of what we were reading, the classic works on autogenics did not come with recorded audio because you were not supposed to listen to somebody else telling you what to do. You're supposed to direct your own behavior, which is what provides the auto part of the autogenics.
Right, yeah. Though there is at least a part in it where you hear a woman saying, I'm calm. And that is at least a mantra that you hear recited in autogenic training, and we'll come back to that later on.
But okay, so what is this technique called autogenic training?
Well, it is an actual desensitization relaxation technique that has existed since the early 1930s. Autogenic, the word comes from the Greek word autogenitos, meaning generated inside the body or self-regulated.
Yeah, I've seen it translated as autogenic, meaning sort of self-starting or self-triggering.
Right, yeah. And so basically the idea here is that German psychologist Johannes Heinrich Schultz, who lived 1884 through 1970, he developed autogenic training with the goal of removing the therapist and or the hypnotist from the equation, focusing on what seemed to be an inner switch that facilitated these states. So the idea is, like the rough argument, I guess you would say, is, okay, you're going to see a therapist, you're going to see a hypnotist, and they're helping you reach this state. But you were the one who, like, allowed it to happen. Like, that switch is not external. It is in you. And therefore, this relaxation, this state that you're reaching is auto-generated. Its origins are within you. Now, later in the episode, we'll get more into the specifics of autogenics and what what research has to say about its effectiveness. But we have to say that this is definitely a topic where the research led us into some unexpectedly weird and decidedly dark material. Namely, first of all, eugenics, which we'll discuss the distinction between autogenics and eugenics here in a bit. They're not directly related concepts. And then also the persecution of homosexuals in Nazi Germany. So fair warning that we're going to be discussing some heart-wrenching content and some examples of humanity at its worst, even as we explore the origins of an otherwise innocuous-sounding practice. So before we turn to Schultz and autogenic training, we have to lay the groundwork a little bit regarding hypnosis and psychology going into the 20th century.
Okay.
So let's start with modern hypnotism or mesmerism, which became popular due to the work of German physician Franz Mesmer, who lived 1734 through 1815. We've discussed hypnotism on the show before. Mesmer's work was a point of interest for a number of individuals, including the inventor of the guillotine, Joseph Ingers Guillotin? Did I say that correctly?
I mean, close enough.
Okay, and then Ben Franklin, of course, was a fan as well.
I believe it's Franklin.
Franklin. Okay.
Ben Franklin effect.
Yeah, one of the funny things about hypnotism is that whatever clinical relevance it actually has, the ways that we most often encounter it are in the more kind of mesmerism tradition as a mm-hmm. kind of like public performance. And I think this in some ways undercuts its credibility as a scientific phenomenon.
Yeah, like we generally encounter it in TV shows, right? There's some sort of a hypnotism episode. Yeah. Somebody's hypnotized and either it's played just for sheer laughs, someone mm-hmm. clucks like a chicken, or it has a more fantastic treatment, in some sort of a fantasy Buffy the Vampire Slayer sort of show.
Or you're putting down the Red Queen and the Manchurian Candidate
oh, yes.
and all that kind
oh,
of stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mind control stuff. All of which it can be kind of distracting when you're trying to understand what hypnotism actually is. We, like you said, we've covered it on the show before. I'll try to give the very short version of our conclusions from previous investigations. First of all, yes, it's basically a real thing. It's not just like made up. On the other hand, no, it is not magic. There's nothing especially spooky going on with it. Hypnosis refers to a particular type of mildly altered state of consciousness, a state of heightened relaxation and, very importantly, focused attention, reduced peripheral awareness, and increased suggestibility. The research makes it very clear that not everybody is equally susceptible to hypnosis. Some people appear to not respond to it at all. Other people seem very suggestible. The stuff you see in movies where people get hypnotized and turned into a sleeper agent assassin, that's not very realistic. I don't think it makes sense to think of hypnotism as a form of mind control. I think hypnotism could better be compared to other mildly altered states of consciousness like the things people achieve in meditation.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you think of it more in terms of a meditative state, mm-hmm. Certainly as opposed to TV mind control, you're far closer to the mark.
Yeah. However, it appears very possible and even consistent with a lot of research that hypnosis could in some cases be useful in treating medical complaints, especially medical complaints with a subjective or psychosomatic component, maybe in pain management or in treating stress. So while hypnosis itself, I think, is a real phenomenon, it's invoked in the service of a lot of hoaxes and fakery and pseudoscience. So when you go into the world of hypnotism and people start making claims about what can be done with it, you should have your guard up.
Absolutely. And that can be said for a number of different meditative practices out there. You know,
sure.
Whenever the claims begin to venture more into the supernatural, be cautious.
I mean, not even just the supernatural, even when they venture into the physically plausible but grandiose.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the people who say like, you know, through my meditation technique or my self-hypnosis tapes, you'll learn to master all, you know, it's your guide to weight loss and confidence in the boardroom and all this stuff people say. There might be some real clinical effects of things like hypnosis, but just be cautious when the promises get big.
Right. I mean, it could kind of like the interview interview episode on the science of yoga that put out several months ago. It's like there are things that yoga can do, and things that the research shows that it can or may be able to do. And then there are things for which there's no like plausible reason that it would have that effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you can extrapolate that to a number of these different mindfulness exercises potentially. So Mesmer's work, again, it interested a number of people. It made quite a splash. One of the individuals that it interested was a man by the name of Oscar Vaught, who lived 1870 through 1955, and his wife, Cecile Vaught Meunier, who lived 1875 through 1962. They were neurologists and neuroanatomists, and they were really these two were really quite a team. I don't think I was specifically aware of them, but they were early pioneers in functional neuroanatomy and genetics, and they made a number of important contributions to the study of the brain during the 20th century. And not only that, their daughter, Martha Vaught, who lived 1903 through 2003, a good solid century there, she was one of the 20th century's leading neuroscientists as well. And then her younger sister, Marguerite Vaught, who lived 1913 through 2007, was a cancer biologist and virologist. So Oscar and Cecile, they clashed with the Nazi regime during this time and were forced out of government service in 1937, and they continued their work in a privately funded institute in Neustadt. One of the sticking points, apparently, with the Third Reich was their collection of Russian contacts. And in fact, Oscar was charged with inspecting the brain of Vladimir Lenin following his death from following a series of strokes.
Yeah. So these were brain experts. They studied the physical structure of the brain and how that contributed to the functioning of the brain. And one of the things that Oscar was apparently interested in was what you could see with how the structures of the brain responded to hypnosis exercises.
Yeah, so he apparently used it with his patients for a number of years. And along the way, he managed to cross paths with this German psychiatrist, this man by the name of Johannes Heinrich Schultz, and reported to him that, you know, his patients could use their own volition to produce sensations of heaviness and warmth in their bodies and transfer into a self-hypnotic state. So Schultz took this idea, combined it with his own experiences using hypnosis with patients, and this brought about the birth of autogenic training. So basically, he just really, you know, dove into this particular topic, like what can be done in the realm of self-regulated self-hypnosis.
Yeah. Now, I think it's important to understand that in the first half of the 20th century especially, there is a lot of stuff happening in the world of psychology and psychiatry that is very interesting but is not what we would probably consider science today.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff going on in this world that I think is better to think of as philosophy. It's kind of more broad observational science than it is science based on controlled experiments and rigor.
Yeah, we're talking about, again, the late 19th century, the early 20th century, the heyday of individuals like Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. The discipline of psychiatry itself was only entering its second century of existence, and the first half of the 20th century was dominated by this idea of psychoanalysis, before chemical advances would bring about a new age of pharmacology in the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah. Now, obviously, it's not just drugs that changed psychiatry.
Right.
I mean, it was empirical methods of all sorts, I think, because you can also run empirical tests on the efficacy of therapeutic techniques that don't involve drugs and that kind of stuff. But the world of Freud and Carl Jung, while, you know, I enjoy their writings. I think they're very interesting, but it's not really science.
If you drill into an idea like the collective unconscious. You know, it's fascinating stuff. It can certainly benefit you from a philosophical standpoint, a creative standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating concepts, but is it something that is has any scientific validity to it? Probably not.
It might be able to generate ideas that could be put to rigorous testing by experimental psychologists and psychiatrists who would come later.
Right. So it was I guess you could say that it was, you know, an age of optimism in many respects. You had all these new tools that were coming online to enable the treatment of nervous conditions that had plagued humanity for quite some time. The secrets of the mind were being explored, and yet – this was also a time of incredible darkness, entailing some truly horrendous studies and, of course, the horrors of eugenics.
That's right. I mean, generally, science and medical practice under the Third Reich is just a litany of horror stories of various kinds. And, of course, psychiatry under the Third Reich is really no different.
Right. And we're not going to attempt to do any kind of a deep dive into that. But we will touch, I think, on some examples that exemplify the sort of the sort of pressure that was applied by the Third Reich on the sciences, and the sort of corrupted results that you get when that sort of relationship is in place. So we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will continue with our story, and we'll bring in the character of Johannes Heinrich Schultz.
All right, we're back. So we've been talking about this idea of autogenics, which is some kind of form of purported self-hypnosis that was created by a German psychiatrist named Johannes Heinrich Schultz in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah, and he is a troubling figure, I think, to figure out. Again, early 20th century, this was the heyday of psychoanalysis, and Schultz certainly believed in the power of psychoanalysis, though he also thought that it was not ideal for the treatment of psychosomatic disorders. In these cases, he became convinced that the key lay in self-hypnosis and, of course, in his concept of autogenic training.
Right. So heterohypnosis would be the opposite of what – heterohypnosis would be where there is it was the so-called authoritarian method,
right,
where there's a hypnotist guiding you,
yeah,
whereas autohypnosis you take into your own hands. Okay, so what's the distinction here with psychosomatic disorders? Psychosomatic refers to problems in the body that are caused or aggravated by psychological factors. So you can have psychosomatic pain. You can have hypochondriasis. Schultz was cited by a biographer to have said, quote, "It is complete nonsense to shoot with psychoanalytic guns after symptom sparrows." So I think what he's saying there is, to whatever extent you can use psychoanalysis, that's more for problems that are fully within the mind, the psychology realm. Psychosomatic disorders, where the problems are somewhere in the body and may have roots in psychological issues, are not best addressed with psychoanalysis. He thought they would be better addressed with hypnosis or even autohypnosis. So Schultz noted that, you know, there were two very common reports of unique body experiences during the process of hypnosis. And those two common reports were heaviness in the limbs and this weird sensation of warmth. How common these sensations were drove Schultz to see hypnosis as a treatment for relaxation in the body, not just something that affects the mind, but something to affect, for example, the autonomic nervous system. And also, based on the reports about what Vogt had been able to achieve with his own patients, Schultz came to believe that the authoritarian figure triggering the hypnotic state within the authoritarian process, within the heterohypnosis, that was not actually necessary.
Yeah, again, the basic idea here is that when we undergo hypnosis, the changes are occurring within us, and with training, we would be able to trigger them without the aid of another person. The patient permits it to happen rather than it being something that the hypnotist does to the patient. That
right.
was Schultz's whole argument.
Yeah.
So inspired by Vogt and his own experiences with hypnosis, Schultz began employing these ideas in private practice.
And this would have been when he opened his private clinic in neurology and psychiatry in Berlin in 1924. So by the 20s, he's already trying this out.
Right. And then in 1932, he published his first book on autogenic training, Das Autogen Training. And again, we'll get to the specifics of autogenic training in a bit here, but in discussing 1932, we're, of course, just a year away from the establishment of the Third Reich, and this is where Schultz becomes a problematic figure. So first, let's be very clear about the Nazi regime. It was a dictatorship and a totalitarian state based on an ideology that celebrated nationalism, the pseudoscience of racial hierarchy, anti-Semitism, scientific racism, and eugenics. Germany contained a great many brilliant minds in 1933, but the Third Reich was only interested in how these minds and ideas could be used to serve the Nazi ideology and the war efforts. And rocketry, I think, is a good example to look at here, just in brief. you know, this was you had German rocket scientists who were inspired by things like science fiction and dreams of exploration. But
when Wernher von Braun,
von Braun is a great example of this. But of course, what did the Third Reich want out of these mines? They wanted weapons. They wanted ways to deliver
the V2, the V1,
et cetera,
rain hell down upon England and punish their enemies.
Yeah. So there was no interest in something like space exploration or moon bases or whatever kind of like, you know, fanciful extrapolation you find in conspiracy thinking.
I think the Third Reich is one of the greatest examples in history of just an utter waste of intellectual potential.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of great scientific infrastructure in Germany in the Weimar period and going into the Third Reich. And the way all of that great intellectual potential was just bulldozed by Nazism is a great tragedy.
So all the sciences become the domain of the state in Nazi Germany. And of course, that also means psychology and psychiatry as well. And really, they were these were fields that were, I think, especially vulnerable because especially at the time, given all the changes that were taking place in these fields, they were highly susceptible to manipulation by a totalitarian regime.
I mean, even the hardest of the hard sciences were under attack by the Nazi ideology. Mm-hmm. You know, like they wanted to rid themselves of what they believed to be Jewish physics, not understanding that physics is physics. Like it doesn't matter what the ethnicity of the scientist who discovered it was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the whole other side to it too. I mean, not only were, of course, the German scientists pressured to be a part of this machine, but then people who were suspected of having ties to, say, the Russians, like the Votes that we discussed earlier, they were at least partially pushed out. And then Jewish scientists were completely pushed out.
But I mean, if there are that many problems in a supposedly hard science like physics, you'd imagine that things get even weirder when you get into burgeoning fields like psychology and psychiatry.
Right. Yeah. So the Nazi regime apparently didn't have any real strong opinions on self-hypnosis or autogenic training. But there were other ideas in the field that were far more central to their ideology. And so all this is going on. Schultz ends up publishing another book on autogenics, but his star continues to rise within German psychiatry. And as his star rises, others fall from grace in this now state-controlled realm of the German scientists, again, namely Jewish scientists. In psychology, it was no different. But what were they to do about psychoanalysis? It was, again, highly favored by Schultz and others, but it was the product of Sigmund Freud, who was, of course, Jewish himself. His books were among those burned, and he eventually had to flee the country as well. So part of German psychiatry at the time, part of the mission statement of the Goring Institute, this was named for Matthias Heinrich Goring, cousin to the more famous and at the time more powerful Hermann Goring. Part of its whole aim was to rid psychiatry of, quote, Jewish influence and establish, quote, a new German psychotherapy. Which, of course, is ludicrous.
Right.
You know, it's like if someone were to say, well, let's just focus on an American science.
Right.
You know, what would that even mean? Would that mean you'd have to press out all like non-American ideas of how the world works and what the cosmos consists of?
I mean, it wouldn't be the only time in history that there's been a kind of like stupid nationalist lens applied to sciences, like not understanding that the sciences are about figuring out what's true about the world and that those things are true no matter what your ethnicity is or what your nationality is. I guess the closest thing to validity you could find there would be that like, well, you might say as a nation we have these priorities about what we want to find out. But yeah, again, this is just a tragedy of stupidity.
So Schultz, again, he keeps focusing on autogenics, but he also ends up getting involved in these ideas that are far more valuable to the Third Reich. So he publishes work supporting eugenics. Eugenics, of course, involves the idea that you should you want to encourage, you know, the good genes within a population by eliminating so-called destructive genes.
Mm-hmm.
And this generally takes the form of pretty horrific efforts like forced sterilization for men with mental retardation, psychiatric or neurological disorders. Those were exactly the forms it took under the Third Reich.
Now, while eugenics was sort of one of the founding principles of the Third Reich ideology, I think it's worth acknowledging that in the first half of the 20th century, I mean, eugenics was all over the place. It was fashionable among intellectual elites all around the world, even in the United States and in other Western nations that ended up fighting the Nazis.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, but yeah, by no means was it a German idea. You saw it, plenty of examples of it in the United States.
We talked a lot about eugenics actually in our interview with Carl Zimmer when
he had
that excellent book about heredity. So if you want to go back and listen to that episode, you can. But yeah, he explores a lot of the roots of eugenics within the United States at the time.
But in this case, yes, the eugenics movement would eventually sterilize some 400,000 individuals by the end of the war. And Schultz also focused on sexual education and the subject of homosexuality and the idea that it could be cured. So at the time, homosexuality was in general poorly understood from any sort of scientific standpoint and was highly susceptible to pre-existing prejudices. We know today, of course, that the notion of curing homosexuality is pseudoscience at best, and generally it's worse than that. A 2019 study published in the journal Science, the largest study to ever analyze the genetics of same-sex sexual behavior, points out that there's no one, you know, gay gene or anything of the sort. Rather, to quote Pam Belloc in the New York Times, quote, "The influence comes not from one gene but many, each with a tiny effect. And the rest of the explanation includes social or environmental factors, making it impossible to use genes to predict someone's sexuality."
Right. So sexual orientation, like almost everything else about us, is in fact controlled by a number of different genes acting in concert with our environment as we're brought up.
Yeah, yeah. It's this complex interplay of nature and nurture, individual and the environment. And more to the point, of course, it's not something to be corrected at all. It's not as it was often thought at the time in some of these regimes, including the Third Reich. It's not a societal problem, though it again is often framed like that and was outlawed as such in various nations. And homosexuality was certainly at odds with the Nazi ideology, which celebrated, among other things, this exaggerated and toxic vision of masculinity. Historians, however, have also pointed out that this Nazi hyper-masculine ethos paradoxically may have encouraged male bonding in homosexual relationships as well. But I guess it's one of these situations where that the kind of proximity of ideal and antithesis are often a common feature of homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, in the sciences of the Third Reich, you had scientists who were taking a eugenics approach to the issue of homosexuality, believing that homosexuality was centered in a person's genes and could therefore be addressed via the violence of eugenics. Schultz, on the other hand, thought psychotherapy was the answer, that homosexuality was based in, quote, perversion, a profound disorder of the entire personality. And that quote was pointed out in a paper that I'm going to refer to again here, titled Johannes Heinrich Schultz and National Socialism by Jürgen Brunner, M.D., Matthias Schrempf, and Florian Steger, M.D., Ph.D. This was published in the Israeli Journal of Psychiatry in 2008.
So here we get around to a different version of anti-gay reaction, right, which instead of thinking, okay, there's a gene we can eliminate somewhere, this instead says, no, it's something that's wrong with how your brain is working and we can sort of train it out of you.
Right.
And unfortunately, this point of view is not entirely gone from the world today.
No, I mean that's the thing. You could take Schultz out of this particular place and time, and you could easily place him, in the United States today, and there would be some place for him with this kind of rhetoric.
Yeah, the most common being things that are known as like gay conversion therapies, which are utterly condemned by every psychological organization. From the American Psychological Association has issued statement after statement saying these treatments do not work and they don't do anything good for the person. They should be discouraged at all costs.
So without a doubt, Schultz definitely echoed and amplified Nazi homophobia and gay persecution within German psychiatry. And that alone is reprehensible. But on top of that, he also engaged in experimentation. So under Nazi rule, homosexuality was illegal in Germany. And it was apparently previously technically illegal as well, though not prosecuted during the Weimar Republic. And convicted homosexuals under the Third Reich were sent to concentration camps. According to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, quote, between 1933 and 1945, an estimated 100,000 men were arrested for violating Nazi Germany's law against homosexuality, and of these, approximately 50,000 were sentenced to prison. An estimated 5,000 to 15,000 men were sent to concentration camps on similar charges, where an unknown number of them perished. And I also read that the death rate in the camps for homosexuals has been estimated at something like 65%. Now, interestingly enough, you know, we briefly touched on during the Weimar Republic how it was not prosecuted, and there was more of a feeling. Really, I've read of liberation. There were actually gay. There was a gay rights movement at the time. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the early days of the Nazi regime, apparently. Its stance on homosexuality was a little more ambiguous and uneven, with some individuals not having really much of a stated opinion, while you had other people like SS commander and chief Holocaust architect Heinrich Himmler being one of the early strong voices in favor of violent persecution of homosexuals, and his view increasingly won out.
Yeah.
So Schulz began to experiment with treating homosexuals through psychoanalysis, including many inmates that were brought in from concentration camps. And part of this was apparently that he needed to demonstrate concrete psychotherapeutic success to maintain his position within the Goring Institute. And according to Brunner et al., between 1923 and 1938, 510 homosexuals were, quote, treated at the Goring Institute. 341 of them were said to be cured, and the cure was tested by forcing the individual to have sex with female prostitutes.
So these all would have been gay men.
Yes. So I think that just paints a horrific picture, obviously.
Right.
Now, Schulz wasn't the only one involved here. According to the U.S. National Holocaust Museum, there was an expanded program of medical experimentation on homosexual inmates that ultimately caused illness, mutilation, and even death with absolutely no scientific benefits whatsoever. So again, we said we were going to be talking about a dark period of history, and so here we are. So the war ends, of course. Schulz dies in 1970 and never faced any repercussions for his ideas or his experiments. And in fact, he continued to discuss his findings, publish his findings even, and supported the outlaw of homosexuality for the rest of his life. And this is apparently not out of the ordinary, sadly, as much of the Third Reich's crimes against homosexuals went unrecognized at a governmental level until well into the 1980s. The German government formally apologized in 2002.
I mean, part of this, I think, would just have to do with attitudes around the rest of the world as well. I mean, think about what happened to Alan Turing, even in England.
Right.
England, which wanted to purport itself to be, the free alternative to the authoritarian Germany, gay people did not have equal rights there at all.
Yeah, and Alan Turing was subjected to the horrors of eugenics. He was chemically sterilized. One of the topics that Brunner and his co-authors discuss concerns Schulz's legacy and to what extent he actually bought into Nazi ideology. Because you'll certainly encounter the argument that, okay, he didn't fully buy into Nazi ideology you also see it written that, okay, through his experiments, he actually retrieved inmates from concentration camps. Though of these, some were ultimately returned to the concentration camps, and even the cured, in the case of soldiers,
so-called cured,
ultimately they were sent back to the front. So both of these would have been high mortality fates. Certainly one is as an inmate and one is a soldier; they're not directly comparable. But it does sound like this argument that he was saving lives in any sense is kind of ridiculous. The conclusion of Brunner and the co-authors is that, well, first of all, they say that, they're limited in that they had to depend on writings rather than interviews. And mm-hmm. certainly they couldn't actually interview Schulz himself. But their conclusion was that Schulz perhaps was more of an opportunist and a political survivor But still, he certainly expressed these homophobic beliefs throughout his life, and that, quote, the use of typical Nazi vocabulary, as well as the dissemination of the Nazi body of thought as late as 1952, give reason to believe that the statements from 1935 and 1940 were not only about opportunistic lip service, but instead were an expression of his fundamental conviction. So we're left with this image of a discipline and a practitioner certainly caught up in the storm of Nazi ideology and also embracing much of its vileness. He helped enable homosexual persecution and engage in abusive, unethical experimentation. And yet he also created this practice of inner calming that is still practiced to this day. We mentioned how autogenic training is maybe, you know, not that widely known here in the United States, but it's apparently more widely practiced or has been more widely practiced in Canada, England, Germany, and Russia.
In Russia, yeah.
So we're going to take another break, but when we come back, we'll discuss autogenic training a little bit on its own. All right, we're back.
All right, so we've been talking about Johannes Heinrich Schultz, the creator of this self-hypnosis process that is called autogenics. The idea is that you could you don't need the authoritarian figure telling you, you know, you are feeling relaxed, you feel your limbs being heavy and all that stuff, that you can train yourself to undergo this process on your own. I thought it was interesting that even though I've read about hypnosis before, I had never really encountered anything about autogenics before you brought up this topic as a possibility to talk about on the show. And I was wondering why it is that I've like never heard of this at all before.
Well, something that I had heard of, and you may have heard of this previously as well, is the practice of progressive muscle relaxation, which is sometimes integrated into yoga practices. I've been to yoga classes where they engage in like a little of this anyway. And this was developed independently by the American physician Edmund Jacobson in 1908. So pretty much emerging from the same realm of psychiatry and contemplation of the human mind.
As we're going to discuss, autogenic training, I think, suffers from a dearth of research into its, high quality research, recent research into its efficacy. But what is out there, a lot of it focuses on different types of relaxation techniques all sort of put together. So it looks at progressive muscle relaxation, autogenic training, and then maybe also something like mindfulness meditation or something.
Biofeedback is also thrown in there.
Yes. Yeah. So it seems to be considered part of a class of stress relief or relaxation exercises.
So a standard autogenics training exercise tends to consist of several phases. There's a heaviness exercise of limb and body relaxation, a warming exercise, a heart regulation exercise, a breathing exercise, and then organs and then head. And it involves spoken mantras and focusing on specific parts of the body. So for instance, you might say that your arms are heavy, and you'll repeat that like six times, and then you'll say, I am very quiet. And then you'll do another six on the arm, on the other arm, and then you'll again return to this mantra of quietness.
Yeah, we were looking for a good recent skeptical scientific source on autogenic training, and I think one of the best things we came across was a chapter in a book. It's a psychiatry textbook called The Principles and Practice of Stress Management, and this chapter was by a professor emeritus in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia named Wolfgang Linden. And Linden points out one thing that's kind of unique to autogenic training, which proponents of autogenic training call passive concentration. So I'm going to read from Linden here explaining what this is. Passive concentration may sound paradoxical in that concentration usually suggests effort. What it means in AT is that the trainee is instructed to concentrate on inner sensations rather than environmental stimuli. And this is indeed somewhat effortful, especially for the novice. If this concentration does not come easily, the trainee is told to let thoughts wander for a while or to rearrange the body position for more comfort rather than to force inner concentration. Not forcing, allowing sensations to happen, and being an observer rather than a manipulator are what the passive refers to. The AT trainee is warned that trying too hard is counterproductive. It may lead to negative reactions such as muscle spasms, and it stands in the way of acquiring the necessary passive attitude. Interestingly, I see a couple of parallels. I'm sure they're unintended, but parallels here with some mindfulness meditation practices.
Yeah. Again, I feel like we come back to the idea that these are all kind of discussing the same phenomena. There are just different ways of getting there. They're sort of, getting to that. You need different sort of trails of language and trails of culture to approach it. Some people are going to be able to best approach it through a trail that is more spiritual, in its trappings. Mm-hmm. Others need something more based in psychiatry, or something that is either attached to the latest thinking or has perhaps an air of history to it.
Mm-hmm. I would say ultimately what all these things have in common to me, it might be not what the proponents of something like autogenic training would say, which is that, it's about the relaxation of the body and the self-control aspect is very important and all that. To me, what seems most important unifying all these different relaxation techniques is the control of attention.
Yeah. Yeah, to be able to take the wandering mind, that's the default mode network, and it's the voice of narrative and all these things that are occurring, our ponderings and our anxiety over past and future, and to be able to sort of refocus that onto something very specific, like what is your arm doing right now, or your breathing being the prime example across numerous different practices, focusing on the breath.
Yeah, I think that's right. So Lyndon says that the passive concentration principle here, the thing we were just talking about, is the one thing that supposedly separates autogenic training from other methods of relaxation techniques like progressive muscle relaxation or biofeedback. It's, if you talk to an autogenics training person, they would probably heavily emphasize this passive concentration part as important. Beyond that, when you go through the different stages, Robert, what you were talking about earlier, where you go through the limb and body relaxation and then the heart regulation and then the breathing and then your guts and then your head, that when you go through these, you will have sort of like formulaic schemes of repeated things that you go through in order to do those different parts of the body each time, and that what you want to do, Lyndon says, is have vivid, personally meaningful imagery to accompany each of these formulaic body relaxation schemes. So I was trying to know exactly what that is, but apparently like for the head, you're supposed to picture something about a cooling forehead, maybe something about water. And then for your guts, it's something about rays of light.
Hmm.
But I just kept thinking, picture your head as a toilet. All the stress is flushing away.
Well, it makes me think back to the book's track, Group Autogenics, Part 1, mm-hmm. Where one of the clips they use is someone saying, your body is a warm orange-colored liquid.
Yeah.
That seems to be potentially a specific example of this, very, very specific bit of mental imagery, and probably one of the details that I really dug about that song. It's like your body is a warm orange-colored liquid. There's something very relaxing about that concept.
I mean, whether or not these techniques actually reduce stress, that image reduces stress for me. I like that.
Like it's weird.
I am
it's
Faygo.
Novel, and it takes you. Yeah, maybe that was the warm Faygo, some hot Faygo to get you through the winter.
So Lyndon writes that in a clinical setting, autogenic training is used primarily to reduce unnecessary autonomic arousal. In other words, to reduce stress. This shouldn't be surprising given what we've already talked about. Though in theory, he points out, it is designed and believed by its advocates to work in any direction. So in theory, it could be used not just to reduce stress but to raise problematically low levels of autonomic arousal. Though how often do you need to do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he mentions like a low heart rate or something.
Okay.
As for the question of whether Schultz himself was rigorous in how he presented the benefits of this technique, Lyndon's writing about a book published by Schultz and a student of his named Wolfgang Luther. I believe this was published in 1969 or 1970. I think Schultz died in 1970, so it would have been right around the time of his death. But Lyndon writes, quote, "For a reader with a strong empiricist bent, reading the original works will likely be a frustrating task because in the ultimate evaluation of AT's effectiveness, no distinction is made by Schultz and Luther among opinions, single case reports, and controlled studies, of which there were precious few." So by 1970, they're still advocating, you know, our technique is great, but there is not a strong experimental record to back that up.
Mm. Now, Wolfgang Luth, he would have been a Canadian at the time, but he had moved there. He was a German by birth and moved there in the late 1940s. And I found that in the Wikipedia entry about him, for instance, it doesn't really mention what he did during the Second World War. I did find another source that said that he served as a junior medical officer on the Eastern Front. And also, he's not to be confused with U-boat Captain Wolfgang Luth, who is a different figure altogether. But Luther would have practiced autogenic training in Canada,
right,
during this post-war period.
Do you know if he was primarily responsible for bringing it to Canada?
I'm not certain on that, but I
wouldn't be surprised.
I kind of suspect that he was, given his affiliation, especially throughout the post-war period with Schultz. Now, there were others, that definitely tried to bring. I mean, certainly it came to the United States and was practiced and is practiced in the United States by some. But one interesting story I came across where someone was strongly advocating for it was a 1977 New York Times report that pointed to. Psychologist and hypnotism advocate Dr. William S. Kroger, who warned in 1977 that the Russians were training their Olympic athletes with hypnosis and autogenic training to improve performance, and that the United States would need to get with the program if they were hoping to keep up.
Now, this is also when they were training psychic assassins, so it all works out.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of tie into the whole Cold War fear of like, okay, the Russians are doing something, or the reverse, the Americans are doing something. Mm-hmm. What if it works? And then adding in perhaps some misinformation and disinformation about it actually working.
Yeah, I mean, it does appear to have been popular with some therapists in Russia. A lot of the studies on the effectiveness of autogenic training are older. I would hesitate to rely on them too much. I mean, I would say overall, autogenic training's efficacy at treating specific diseases such as hypertension, I think, remains sort of an open question. But Lyndon does draw attention to a few studies in his assessment of the effectiveness of AT. For example, he writes, quote, "A particularly striking demonstration of treatment effect variability is provided by," I got some names here, "Ivazian, Zaitsev, and Uranev in 1988. Who randomly assigned hypertensive patients to either AT or a no-treatment control condition. When mean changes were broken down into percentage improved ratings, the following figures emerged. In the autogenics training treated group, 32% improved, 59% remained unchanged, and 9% deteriorated. In the control group, 59% also remained unchanged, thus the same as the last group, 11% improved and 30% deteriorated. Clearly, therapy did little for the majority of patients, whereas the between group difference is effectively attributable to treatment effects consisting of both direct improvement and the prevention of worsening. Thus, valuable healthcare funds may be better invested if patients who are not going to benefit from treatment can be identified a priori and left out of the treatment comparison." And there are a few other studies that Lyndon talks about that show, you know, maybe there is some effectiveness of techniques like AT at reducing stress or physiological arousal, maybe reducing some downstream effects of stress like hypertension. I wasn't seeing anything that makes it look like autogenic training is any kind of, you know, like magic bullet that's gonna solve all the world's problems, though it may have some benefits similar to some other relaxation techniques.
Now, another idea that comes up in autogenic training is the idea that in these practices you'll have like this surge of, say, negative emotion.
Oh yeah,
that is ultimately like a purging of negative feelings from the body.
Oh,
right?
Oh yeah, this was Schultz's idea of autogenic discharge. This is where, I mean, so there are some elements of the autogenic training that you can see. Okay, this just seems like this is a technique that could plausibly have psychosomatic benefits, and you know, could reduce stress and all that. There are other things that seem a little more kind of Freud-y, just kind of like,
yeah,
you know, like talking about the discharging of all these pent up things that come out during the process. I think there was this belief in like discharging of sexual tensions and things like that, which I don't know. I don't see any good reason to believe stuff like that is happening.
Yeah. I mean, on one hand, I think like a lot of us, you know, I can certainly think to examples in my own life where I'm engaged in some sort of, yogic or relaxation, meditative experience. And there is some feeling of purging, you know, of some emotional negativity, you know, coming out and then you're being free of it. On the other hand, one of the frequent things that occurs when you try and meditate or enter any kind of relaxed state is that you'll stumble and sometimes you'll fail, right? And the more you try and focus on nothing, sometimes your brain will just really want to stab you with a big piece of negative shrapnel. And that's just how our brain often works. And it seems like this might be an interesting way of working that into a meditative practice, so that when those thoughts emerge, that's just the purging in process. I don't know, to some extent, I could see that being a helpful technique if it keeps you on the horse, as it were. You know, if it keeps you on the bicycle of meditation and it keeps you from just giving up and stopping.
Sure.
So I think that, you know, this all makes for an interesting case to look at in considering, you know, first of all, how state-promoted ideology can impact professions and professionals. And it also presents a problem of how we relate to a possibly beneficial idea that springs from the life and the mind of someone who's engaged in unethical or morally reprehensible movements. So first of all, I will say, if you're listening to this and you have some experience with autogenic training, you've practiced it yourself, you've looked into it yourself, et cetera, we would obviously love to hear from you about this, your firsthand take on the practice itself and maybe even on its history as well, because I think this is ultimately an interesting case to look at in considering how state-promoted ideology can impact professions and professionals. And it also presents a problem of how we relate to possibly beneficial ideas that spring from the lives and minds of people engaged sometimes in unethical or morally reprehensible movements. Now, of course, is autogenics the only concept or idea to have its origins in a problematic individual? Certainly not. Though it perhaps is a pretty jarring example to turn to, given his role, again, in gay conversion therapy under the Third Reich. Mm-hmm. But this is a question we have to contemplate regarding a number of different concepts and ideas that have any kind of historic origin, or even not so historic origins, because ultimately, no matter how elevated a concept may seem to us, no matter how, great a particular teaching, they are inevitably, have their origins in the minds of human beings who at the very best are flawed and at worst can be engaged in monstrous practices.
Well, there have been other cases I can think of where there are attempts to distance a practice that in some way people believe to have found helpful from a problematic individual who it came from. I mean, I think about, for example, there were some efforts I know to try to come up with a kind of secular version of mantra-based meditation to kind of get away from the transcendental meditation movement origins.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And there's certainly – you see examples of this throughout yoga practices as well, where there'll be, say, a particular school of yoga that emerges, and then the individual that is associated with, there'll be some scandal or whatnot that occurs. But people will want to hold on to the teaching. So, sometimes it's more of a rebranding attempt or to take, what works about something, distance it from the individual and celebrate it there, practice it there.
I mean, ultimately, a corrupt yogi or even a gay conversion therapy Nazi does not own the way you find peace, whatever your techniques are.
True. So obviously, again, this is a topic that we'd love to hear from folks about if you have any experience with autogenic training, certainly, but also just this broader question we're asking here as well. We're curious to hear what everyone has to say. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of our show, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Stuff to Blow Your Mind is everywhere. Wherever you get it, just make sure that you rate, review, and subscribe. This really helps us out in the long run. And for our listeners out there, any listeners who are in the Atlanta area, want to let you know that there is an event coming up part of the Atlanta Science Festival. It's called How Snakes Work. It is going to be on Saturday, March 7th, 2020, from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. You can find out about it at atlantasciencefestival.org. But it's pretty cool because it is a team-up effort from How Stuff Works, the website from which we spawned, and the Amphibian Foundation, Mark Bandinka's organization. Mark Bandinka, of course, is a friend of the show and has been on to discuss amphibians, snakes, lizards, and more.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. We'll be right back.